Hello, and welcome back to another episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. I am Mariam Adams. I'm the co-producer of this podcast, and for the most part, I do the behind-the-scenes work. But today, I'm stepping out from the shadows to interview an author of a book that has been much anticipated by me and many of my colleagues. Today, I'm in conversation with Catu Pidda, a poet, a former journalist. Catu was raised in Hampshire, but grew up and spent her childhood holidays in South Africa, where her great-grandfather, Jan Smuts, had been the Prime Minister. We will be discussing her book, Moederland, which explores her family's charged legacy through the lens of nine very different women. Pidda critically considers the long-forgotten history of the woman in her lineage and beyond. And in her work, she looks at their power, their shame, and their legacy. Thank you for joining us, Catu.
Thank you for having me.
It's special to be speaking to you today, and I look forward to what will essentially be an intergenerational conversation, not just between you and I, but the one we will be having about the woman who came before us and the woman who will come after. I'm fairly certain our ancestors' paths must have crossed back in the day one way or another. I'm going to use your own reflections as the framework for this conversation because your work and your words speak for themselves as you grapple not only with these stories, but the aftermath of them too. Your writing itself is beautiful and eloquent, but it is also critical, considerate, and accessible. So to situate the listener, I want us to open with a selected reading from the prologue, and I'll hand over to you when you're ready.
Struggling to understand on which page to find myself in this contested history, I construct family trees, pin them to the back of my study door. The same names, my names, hang like fruit on this tree. I run my finger down lists of the dead, where women's names are misplaced as they marry, the lost girl sliding into the depths as the grown woman takes her husband's identity. I try on the masks of the past, consider how South Africa has a powerful narrative attached to it, with tragedy, oppression, blood, how it is a narrative populated by men. Those old half-truths frustrate me, those battles and political wrangles with their exclusive masculine patina, the women consigned to silence, swelling a crowd, swaddling a baby. How do people like me fit in? Where are we while the camera is on the men? The family tree remains silent, a palimpsest written over by successive generations. It does not say a word about a woman's greed for honey or whether she showed her teeth when she smiled. It does not say a word about how a white woman in Africa might fit into the jigsaw of her country, how she might relate to men in that country or people of a different colour, how she might shape the past and so the present and the future. Not a word about this secret history. Identity is fluid and contingent, and those names are no more than gravestones, all present together in death. But once asked, a question cannot be unasked. Complicit, adjective, meaning, involved with others in an activity that is unlawful or morally wrong. Also, culpable, Middle English, adjective, meaning, deserving blame. The family tree remains silent about all of this, about what it means when the people whose DNA threads through yours, from whose wealth you benefit, put together the cage that entrapped and maimed millions of human beings, about what it means to live in the heart of whiteness, the shambok of the slave owner in your ancestral hand, the sweat of an African feeding your body, what it means to live 6,000 miles distant, so that the result of those beatings, those separations, is hidden by mountains and deserts. The bloodline that ties me to South Africa leads directly down into this abyss. Inside its most celebrated son, my great-grandfather, Prime Minister Jan Smuts, pulls a dark slick of pride and shame. Working through the past, the Germans call it, as they struggle to come to terms with the Third Reich, Vergangenheitsbewältigung, which you will also find listed under South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, designed to lay the horrors of apartheid to rest. But apartheid's legacy persists, the Vergangenheitsbewältigung unfinished. These ancient tangles, too complex to unravel, too divisive to lay bare. I think about belonging and exclusion, about those leaky frontiers between guilt and innocence, about whether that burden can be unpacked, its parts used to construct something more worthwhile. It is an ongoing process delivering us from evil. I wonder about looking the basilisk in the eye, if I am brave enough to hurt the people I love by bringing our shame into the light, by unpicking the tapestry of our identity. I think about collective guilt and individual responsibility, how impunity allows sin to continue to walk among us, how Archbishop Desmond Tutu says that because human beings live in communities, groups must acknowledge their part in the past in a symbolic confession of wrongdoing. I think about the collective looking away from violence done to Black bodies, the theft, dispossession, and denial of Black people as human beings, all the centuries that edifice took to build, the weight of the ship of history, how long she takes to turn, and how empty she is of women's stories, not only of our triumphs, but of our crimes, our complicity. How would it be, I think, if I could excavate the life stories of these women all the way back to the beginning? If I could find their stories and try to understand how we got here, how I got here? I picture the women of my prehistory lined up, daughter to mother, back and further back in a chain, an insane game of Chinese whispers, where what the first mother said is changed in almost all its essentials, language, form, content. How all those lost words shape South Africa into her monstrous, distorted present. And I think it would help us all to bear it, this history, to understand where it, where we, come from. After a while, I pick up my pen, turn on my laptop, begin to reconstruct.
Thank you. It's affecting, that prologue, and it really sets us up for essentially what you're going to read throughout the book. So my first question, I think it's important to start with, is why your family story? Could you speak about the complexity of being a descendant of Jan Smuts and also of writing about your ancestors, considering that, as you said, it was a point of pride, but also of pain and of shame, especially in a modern context?
I think in answer to thinking about why my family history, I think I felt that it was my responsibility as somebody who writes for a living to look at it and examine it. And whilst I'm not myself a South African, I do carry that heritage, which has resulted in such terrible crimes being committed across the South African landscape. And it seemed to me when I started looking at it that it started from the very beginning. I don't think a lot of people realized that the Cape was a slave society originally. So Angela Van Bengal is one of my characters, and she's an enslaved person who's taken as a young girl from Bengal to the Cape. And she herself actually married a white settler, and her children did move across the colour line. But after that, it became harder and harder. And the society was very stratified along racial lines, as we know. And as I went through these women's histories, I found more and more behaviour which created and reinforced these racial divisions. I think when I started, I'd expected to be writing about oppressed women and, you know, their interesting lives and what they'd done to fight against oppression, which that did happen. But I also found that they were themselves responsible for those behaviours. Obviously, Icy Cricker is one of my main characters in the book. She was married to Jan Smuts, and she always supported him. She didn't believe that women should be in parliament. She talked about African people as being childlike. And whilst Jan Smuts was a world statesman, he also wrote some of the legislation which became apartheid. And when we were growing up, there was a sense of pride in this. I mean, it's not really surprising if there's a statue of your great-grandfather in Parliament Square. Mm-hmm. You know, it feels like something to celebrate, but what I found was that how could we celebrate that if we didn't take, you know, you can't just celebrate the good things that someone did. You also have to understand things that they did which were very damaging to other people. Yeah. So I felt it was my responsibility to look into that.
As anyone in your family, how's the reception been to it? Just off the cuff.
Pretty much Fine, actually. In the UK, my family are Quaker, and Quakers spend quite a lot of time trying to make sure, trying to help people become more equal in society. So on that side, nobody minded. In South Africa, I don't know yet. I have to say, I don't know how the older generation feel about it. Mm-hmm. My cousin Richard, who features in the book, he and his wife Anne have adopted three African children, and they have one biological daughter, and he's been hugely supportive of it. So generally speaking, positive. My aunt Petronella features in the book, and my aunt Sarah lives in Durban, and they've also been supportive of it.
I'm glad that it was warranty. I think it's clear and glaringly obvious as to why you needed to and why you chose to write the story from the female perspective, to figure out who the women were, where they fit in the jigsaw, what their role was, and how big it was. You also explore complicitness and culpability. And I love on page 68, and through telling the story of Anna Sick, you get to the core of this question of the role of women and the consequence of that role. You say, as it is so often, women are a roaring absence at the heart of the historical record, but life is as much about the quotidian as it is affairs of state, and it is women who shape that everyday reality. From the sheets on which bodies wake, through the day, to the evening meal that feeds it, and through the relationships shared at that table, in that bed, through the pattern of her life, Anna Sick shapes 18th century Cape society. Can you talk a little bit more about Anna Sick, how she shaped society? Yes, and touch on that idea of the essentially running an estate in miniature and what it looks like.
Yeah, so Anna Sick, she was a really interesting character. I was really fortunate to find academic study on her, which really brought her life to light. She married young, as they all did, and she married a man who was a rich settler, and he subsequently died. And because Cape Dutch women could inherit estates, she actually inherited the estate, so she owned it, which meant that when she remarried, it still remained her estate. And that was particularly fortunate because her remarriage was a mistake in that Michael Otto was the name of her new husband, and he was an extremely brutal man, as far as we can tell. Did things like tying enslaved people up and coating them with honey and leaving them there so that the insects crawled all over them. And it seems to me quite likely that he was quite abusive towards his wife and his children. And she managed to separate herself from him. So they didn't get divorced, but they separated, and he went to live somewhere else, which left her running this estate, which she managed extremely well. Again, it was with the help of enslaved people that she managed it, but they did everything from making soap, making candles, right through to growing all the wheat and making the wine. She also, though, the other side of it is that she had a lot of children and a lot of grandchildren. And I think that that is at the base of this very rapid expansion across the Cape landscape. The indigenous population, the Kikoi, were wiped out, all but wiped out within about 50 years, largely through smallpox. And this allowed, so the white population took over their lands, and they pushed the frontier out very quickly, all the way to the Fish River. So a really interesting looking at the female role in the expansion of the colonial state, and that frontier, and how the number of children they have and the way that they run their estates so that there's enough food and so on enables that.
Setting the scene of European expansion is exactly what you do. You do this in the story of Elsa Klutter, who initially, when she arrives in the Cape from Germany, she moves to the Lisbic River, to Oud Bay, and then to the Drakensberg. And you sort of set the scene of how the expansion looks and how it happens. But what I found very interesting is when you speak about to Elsa, it was just day-to-day life. It was just survival. When you speak about things like her marriage, having her children, all while, and sort of instilling these racial ideas. And my question is, Elsa is just one of many of the women in history whose actions, decisions, they had far-reaching consequences. How much of it was intentional? How much of it was just survival?
Yeah, it's hard to tell, isn't it? And I think this actually, for me, is at the core of the book. It's that we all live our lives and we're just trying to get through day-to-day life, and none of us are perfect. And I'm absolutely not seeking to excuse their behaviour at all. I believe that we should live our lives more consciously. And I do myself try and like live my life more consciously, but we are trapped within the frameworks that we live in. It's quite hard to step outside of that. So when she was little, she was sleeping on the floor of a barn with a small hut with sort of, I think the sheep and the cattle were there as well. So it's not as if that they were living in sort of gilded wealth whilst oppressing other people. So people, they take the small portion of power which is given to them and try and use it to make their own lives better, I think. But it's a way of understanding, I think. And also, I think what's important is that if we understand that's what they were doing, then we can look at our lives now and understand what we might be doing, which might be perpetuating those inequities or creating other inequities.
And instilling ideologies. The premise of her story is that her husband is actually quite infatuated and has this entire love affair with a slave woman, a young slave woman. And so there's this domestic drama that sets the scene for all of the deep hatred as well. I thought frustration does boil from that point alone, you know? Okay, that's really interesting.
Yes, because I think that is how racism perhaps sometimes perpetuates itself. It's how you act personally and why you're doing things, you know, even, yeah.
I imagine it, or like the way you've painted this picture, it's like this one woman sort of made the decision to further these racial barriers. And like she happens to be the woman who had all the kids that make up, you know, the population. And so it's interesting how these things that seem mundane and they're like non-issues, they're so small on the bigger scale, actually, you know, they end up being the core of ideologies and belief systems. So we've spoken about the household and the making of a home. And a quote I really loved is when you said, "In this world, it is not love that will remain us, but pots. These copper funnels and tea canisters are not frivolous. They are the thin threads of culture that tie isolated farmhouses across the empty miles of scrub, across the mountains and the rivers to Cape Town." So this speaks to the tangible history, the memory, the identity. And in your case, it can be taken far beyond the context of pots. When you look at the South African landscape and you look at the architecture of buildings, the vineyards of wine farms and the language, do you want to talk more about your reflections on visiting these living history sites for your family?
It's interesting that I'm so pleased that you identified that and that quote. So that quote that you gave, actually, it's a Philip Larkin poem which that talks about what will remain of us is love. So that's what I was referring back to. Mm-hmm. But I think what really struck me about all of this was the female nature of it. So the home is where women live. That's where we were confined to for so long. And it's where all of our agency, all of our intelligence has played out over the centuries. And for so long, we weren't allowed the authority to speak as if we'd done anything. So it felt like we didn't do anything. But you and I know that existing as human beings, we're doing stuff all of the time. So when I went to visit these different homesteads, it was really interesting. My husband was just not interested in social history. He's lovely. He'll come with me. But he was like, oh, another one of these. Why do we keep going to these houses? But I think it's because it's where I could relate to it, you know? I could understand what it was like to try and run a household, to try and raise children, and how that relates to the wider society that you're in, I think. And actually, virtually every single woman, I could identify a house that she'd lived in and that she had shaped the reality around her. Even my grandmother, there's a house in Street in Somerset where my aunt and uncle now live. And that's where my South African grandmother married my English grandfather, and they lived in this household. And that's what she did with her life. She had a Cambridge degree. She was a very bright woman. But back in the 1920s, it was very difficult to be a married woman and have a career. So all of that intelligence was poured into this household in Somerset.
Oh, that's interesting. That's good. And yeah, I love that when you spoke about like driving up, I mean, you set the scenes when I see you driving past like townships across the highway, and then you go up into Fahilene, however you pronounce the word. I mean, did you feel something inside when you arrived at these spaces?
I think that they're very beautiful. I mean, I really do genuinely think that those Cape Dutch houses are astonishingly beautiful. But in the modern world, it's quite hard to see things without understanding where they come from. So I live in Bristol in the UK, and this is a city built on sugar and enslaved people. So it has really beautiful buildings, you know, golden sandstone Georgian mansions. They're just stunning. But you're looking at them and you just know that the money that came to pay for them came from untold human suffering. And I think I felt the same way about these Cape Dutch homesteads. Now that I've done the research and understood that they were propped up by a slave society, it's a weird, like it's still beautiful. You still feel that pleasure, but at the same time, it's tainted, I think.
And with your children, would you want them to visit? I mean, they visited some of the places, you know, jumping in the pool, you take in the history. when they are or older, would you want them to experience these sort of things? And will you take them back for the regular pilgrimage to visit the portrait of Sibylla Pussman, which hangs within the halls of Fort Constantia?
Apparently it's moved. My mother went to have a look for it and she couldn't find it. So we do come to South Africa fairly regularly, and my children love it, but they live in the household with me. So they understand the complexities or that, you know, the power imbalances and those kind of things. I think it's difficult for children. They're still finding their way, aren't they? I think of one of my nieces who she doesn't really want to be associated with this heritage because she finds it so shameful. So many of her friends are of African origin in the UK. And I think it would be hard for her to try and explain to them what it all means, I think. But she's only 17, so you know that there's time, I think. I feel that denying your heritage can lead you into societies into all sorts of difficulties, and we need to know what it is so that we can move forward.
You have led me into my next question very nicely, because we're talking about living history and we're talking about what we as a society choose to remember. You do explore what visual redressing looks like in a modern context, from airport names to statues and memorials. You say statues are about nation building, of course, about how a nation recreates its past and what it remembers to create its future. What are your thoughts on redressing? And do you think that there is a place for remembering and keeping these statues and memorials and names, or do you think that there's a place for changing it?
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? And it's people get so upset about statues. I feel that they give a really one-sided view of history. They sort of promote, there's no women, very few statues to women. There's very few statues to any people of colour. they're promoting, for me, they're promoting the idea that these white men, colonial men, that they deserve to be up on a pedestal. I mean, you could think, oh, let's put up statues to other people. But it really, for me, I just think that I don't really see the point of having them around. They make some people feel bad. They make other people feel like this history was okay. If there's a statue up, then obviously the history was okay because it's being celebrated. So personally, I think we should take them all down and put them in a museum, maybe with like some explanation.
Well, rumor has it, the statues are, I mean, many of the statues of figures less in favor at the moment are stored at the Fort Ricker Monument, like in the basement of, don't know if you've read about that's just a rumor.
But it's interesting what you say about in favor now. Do you know what I mean? That kind of says it all, doesn't it? It should be, yes.
I mean, back in the day, the Roman empires, when their emperors fell out of favor and were killed, they would immediately like completely rid themselves of all like memory, memento of these people, so that they're sort of like pushing statues into the rivers, you know, taking faces off of coins to make space for what's to come and to like steal immediately. Unfortunately, those sort of things, they don't work in a context like South Africa and, I mean, in the rest of the world, because I feel like you are living proof of like things come after and context changes.
I live in Bristol, and I think one of the other things about statues is how long they stay up for. We had this statue of Edward Colston, who he was a man who gave a huge amount to the city of Bristol, but he was also not, these days you wouldn't think, a very good man. He made a lot of his fortune through enslavement of other human beings. But that statue stood for years when really it should have come down, and it took individuals. It was a criminal act. They took the statue down and they threw it in, covered it in graffiti, and they threw it in the river into Bristol Harbour. So they had to, in order to remove this statue, they had to commit a crime. And yeah, I'm not saying I condone criminal behaviour, but it just astonishes me that these things just stay for so long.
So this book is, it's been 10 years in the making, and you've relied on a number of sources. There's primary sources such as Anna's Dagboek, which is essentially a diary of her wild adventures and a colonial conquest, should I say. So what was it like finding these sources, using these sources, and the research that went into this book?
Inevitably, with the women who are further off in history, there were many less resources for me to use, but I did try my best to find primary sources. So the very early women, so Krotoa, she's mentioned a lot in the journal of the commander of the Dutch East India Company. Of course, it's a very biased view, but it does give you something to work with. I wanted to write something which was true. I didn't want to make too much up. So everything in there is as accurate as I could make it. I wanted it also, though, to be readable, and it is a creative work. So I did imagine what it might have felt like. So some of the emotion in there I obviously had to invent. It was interesting, over the course of the 10 years, I'm not alone in re-examining women's history or trying to find women's history. So more things would be published as I went along. So that was really interesting to walk alongside female academics as they were working. The more recent women, I had access to family letters, thousands of family letters. And with that, it was a different process. It was, rather than having too little, I had too much, and I had to find the narrative that I wanted to tell within those letters. And the most recent woman, my aunt Petronella, I spoke at some length to herself and her husband about what their lives had been like, and they were very supportive. And then towards the end, my editor said, you need to make the ending stronger. Can you find out what they were doing during the elections? Because it ends in 1994 with the first non-racial elections. So I emailed them and they both sent back to me these really interesting things, pieces about what they've been doing. So Petronella had been a peace monitor and Lionel had actually been in Cape Town when Mandela climbed onto the platform. It was, you have to know what question to ask. Like if you don't know, I hadn't even occurred to me to ask that question, which in retrospect seems a bit strange. But as soon as I asked this, I got all of this richness of material.
My last question is, was there a woman's life that you connected with most or felt moved by most when doing this work?
It's a really interesting question. Some of them I was repelled by, I would say. So Margarita Retief, who sort of seemed to cling on to this sort of racial power that she had. And sometimes it was more complex. So Anna Retief is, she went on the Great Trek. She started on it when she was 5 months pregnant with a very sickly husband. So a woman of huge resource. And she dragged her wagons over mountains and across rivers. But she did all of that because she didn't want to be held equal to a person of color. So that was a kind of interesting thing. One of my favorite characters is a very minor character she's minor in my book, she's not minor in her own life, called Nontando Jabavu. She was a Xhosa writer who by Quaker ancestors took to the UK, and she had a Quaker education. She married a Quaker and she wrote two beautiful memoirs of African life. I don't know if I liked it because I could read her own words, so I could feel her, but also because of the nature of what I was writing, I didn't have that many people of color and I didn't want to appropriate anybody's stories. So it felt like a privilege to be able to read that side of things.
I really enjoyed reading about your great-grandmother. What an interesting woman. I think she's very complex, which I enjoyed. And she just, at the end of the day, wants to potter around, yeah. You know, in her garden and while her husband's off.
It was very frustrating writing about her, I would say, as a modern woman who's had a career. And, you know, I couldn't really understand why this incredibly bright woman was behaving in that way. So actually tracing her life was so interesting, you know, that she grew up in the Cape and then went through the Boer War and she lost children and hated the British, and then her children married English people, English speaking people, and one English person. So she had to put that aside. And yes, her husband's going off having this amazing, being a world statesman. Really interesting. Yeah. She really reminded me that human beings are human beings with all of the complexity that goes with that. She made her choices because of a very, you know, complexity of character, situation, gender, all of those things. But she also changed through her life, as you say, and perhaps as an older woman, she began to think maybe she could step slightly forwards.
This is the time where I remind listeners that Katu Peder's book Moederland is published by John Murray Publishers and is distributed by Jonathan Ball Publishers. It is available at all good bookstores, and it's recognizable by its striking cover, which features an artwork by William Kendridge. So go out and get your copy. And thank you so much, Katu, for being here and for this conversation.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been really interesting talking to you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.